Okay, everyone, I think it's about time for us to start the week five lectures of the Principles of Banking. And this week, Jari-Mikko Meriläinen is going to speak about the regulation in the banking sector today and tomorrow. And then I will give the final lecture for my part on Wednesday at 8 o'clock. So I hope that you are able to wake up so early. And next week, I will give you more details about Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen's visit on next week, because he should be giving also his lectures in Zoom. But today, let's start from Jari-Mikko's presentation. Welcome, Jari-Mikko.
Thank you.
We're happy to have you here. You are one of the most recent staff members in our department, and I leave you to the introduction of yourself. So welcome, and the stage is yours.
Right, thank you, Juha. It's nice to see you here. I think there is I and Juha and 10 others present. I really would have liked to meet you face to face, but given that the situation is what it is, well, it's good that we can organize these lectures here in Zoom. Well, my name is Jari-Mikko Meriläinen, and I have been here in the JSBE for 1 year now. I graduated from the University of Vaasa 3 years ago. Then I worked at the European Central Bank for 1 year, and from the ECB, I came here to the University of Jyväskylä. And I'm going to speak about banking regulation during these 3 hours or 3.5 hours that I have time. Here is some time series data. I collected some data to demonstrate the current situation in the banking sector. Just three example banks. Probably you all are familiar with these three banks. Deutsche Bank, it's the German banking giant. Then Nordea is the one that we have here in Northern Europe that moved its headquarters from Sweden to Finland in 2019. Then Santander, it's the Spanish banking giant. And here is the pre-tax profitability of these three banks. It's pre-tax profits relative to total assets. As you can see, Santander is not doing very well. It's the Q2 of 2020. They booked 8 billion euros of losses, plus they had some tax liabilities of 3 billion euros. So together, those make minus 11 billions of profits for the Q2. Deutsche Bank and Nordea, they still are slightly profitable, but the situation in Santander, it's not as dramatic as this may suggest, because these are write-downs and loan loss provisions for the future expected losses. Santander is very big in Spain, and it's also very big in the UK, and the countries that certainly are not doing well in this corona crisis are Spain and the UK. And we can see the results in this figure or in this chart. Santander has made massive losses or has booked massive losses for the Q2 of 2020. So I'm about to speak a bit about systemic importance, because a thing that changed in the new regulation is that we identified and designate systemically important banks and protect them with capital buffers. I will return to Santander a little bit later. The next two lectures, they focus on the changes in the banking regulation that were prompted by the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. Many of you probably are so young that you don't remember the financial crisis very well, but that doesn't matter. But in any case, this financial crisis, it caused quite big changes in the regulation. because many important factors simply were not recognized in the earlier regulation. And a major change in European banking regulation also is that the supervision in the euro area is now managed by the SSM, or the Single Supervisory Mechanism. We still have national supervisors, but they, together with the ECB, they form this SSM that manages banking supervision in the euro area. And also, I think three days ago, it became official that Croatia and Bulgaria joined the banking union, which means that they will become members of the SSM. Probably you know the name Lehman Brothers. It was a century-old bank, an investment bank that had headquarters at the Times Square in New York. It collapsed during the financial crisis of 2008. This is the most common example of the financial crisis, but it didn't cause it. It's a massive oversimplification to say that Lehman Brothers caused the financial crisis. It ignited the market turmoil in September 2008, but many things happened even before the collapse of Lehman Brothers. For example, in Europe, in the UK, a bank, Northern Rock, bankrupted already 1 year before Lehman Brothers did. And according to the classification of this Leuven and Valencia, it's a very common classification. We had systemic banking crisis in many Western European countries, for example, in Austria, Belgium, Denmark, and so on. Public sector interventions were needed to protect financial stability, that is taxpayer money. And the new regulation, it aims to decrease the probability that we need taxpayer money to save banks. A fundamental change in the regulation is recognition of systemic importance, because failing systemic banks devastate the whole banking sector. Therefore, these systemic banks are now identified and protected to prevent all the situations where systemically important banks send shocks through the financial system, especially if these banks are global, like Deutsche Bank or Santander, that operates in almost every country of the world. These banks are protected by the new regulation. It's designed to prevent the collapse of this systemically important institution. The logic briefly is this, that if we have expected loss or expected impact, it equals loss given default times probability of default. Systemically important banks, they are required to hold more capital, which means that the probability of default of these banks decreases, which leads to lower expected impact or expected loss. The new regulation is designed to lower the likelihood of default of the systemically important banks in such a way that their expected impact or expected loss equals the expected impact of a failing bank that is not a systemically important bank. This is quite straightforward. Probably you already have heard these primary bank functions many times during this course, but they are to accept deposits and grant loans, that is to transform deposits to loans, and they provide a safe haven for depositors, and they manage payment traffic. Banks also have other functions than these, but these are the three primary functions that are mentioned in every textbook that concerns banks and banking. These three functions, they are protected also in this regulation that concerns systemic importance. So we come to the question that what is systemic importance? We have banks, we have hundreds or even thousands of banks alone in the euro area. How do we exactly designate one bank as systemically important and say that some other bank is not systemically important? But for this, there exists a methodology. It's called Global Systemically Important Banks Assessment Methodology and the Additional Loss Absorbency Requirements. This is integrated as a part of the Basel III regulatory framework. The first official publication was published in 2011. That is a few years after the financial crisis. I think the oldest document that I have found is from 2009. So that was quite soon after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. So probably the preliminary work, it began somewhere already in 2009. By the way, systemically important institution, it equals this too big to fail. This too big to fail should not be used in academic or analytic discussion. Today, these too big to fail banks, they are called systemically important institutions. So if you are writing your thesis or some other essay, do not use this too big to fail. Replace it with this systemically important institution. But what you can use is too big to save. There's also another very similar term in the literature. As far as I know, too big to save does not yet have an official term such as this systemically important institution. In any case, these global systemically important banks, briefly, I mean, they are abbreviated as G-SIBs. This G-SIB methodology is used to designate these systemically important banks. Basically, this methodology is indicator-based. It calculates a score for each bank, and we use this score to designate these banks as G-SIBs, although it has some subjective elements, but basically it is an indicator-based score, a sum of several sub-scores. A G-SIB score is calculated for each bank that is larger than a certain threshold, and this score is then compared to a cutoff point. And if a bank has a G-SIB score that is higher than this cutoff point, that is 130 basis points, this bank is designated as a G-SIB. This is very simple. This is one of the subjective parts of this score, this cutoff points. It really is just a matter of decision where the regulator has decided to set this. And if the score is lower than this cutoff point, then the bank is not a G-SIB. This is very simple, but we will return to this later. It's quite clear that when we think that what banks are systemically important and what are not, bank size has to be one of the determinants. And I have been told that bank size has been used to measure systemic importance in some jurisdictions even before this G-SIB methodology existed. And probably this bank size has been the starting point also when they constructed this G-SIB methodology. So unsurprisingly, bank size is included in this G-SIB methodology as well. And in the G-SIB score, bank size is measured by total exposures. exposure is quite close to assets. So if you think total exposures as total assets, they almost are the same thing. In total exposures, also off-balance sheet items are included. And in this GSIP methodology, bank variables are measured relative to global aggregates in the same variables. That is, the indicators, they measure a bank's relative share or importance of the global aggregate. That is, we take every single bank exposure in the world, sum them together, and use that as the denominator when we calculate the GSIP score for bank size. So banks, I mean, a bank's total exposures are divided by the denominator, that is total bank exposures in the world. This is then multiplied by 10,000 basis points to get the sub score for bank size. The denominator end of the year 2018, that is 75 trillion and so on. Well, it's about 76 trillion euros. This principle is then applied for each of the subscores. So this raises questions why they have not rounded this denominator. Why is so precise? Why not simply use 76 trillion? Why it's 75 trillion and 921 billion? But in any case, this is every bank exposure in the world. So if a bank, say Santander, has exposures in Latin America, where they also are big, they are included in this denominator, that is in the total exposures in the world. And this total, I mean, the GSIP score is then a sum of five separate scores. One, the first one is the size score. Then we have a score for substitutability. There is a score for interconnectedness, one for complexity, one for cross-jurisdictional activity. All of these are equally weighted, or they don't have any special weights. The interconnectedness score, as the name implies, it means that how connected the bank is. This is from a study using large exposure data to gauge the systemic importance of SSM significant institutions. They used regulatory data to calculate how connected banks in the SSM really are. The blue color indicates French banks. I think number one, it was BNP Paribas, that is this French banking giant. I don't remember now what was the number two, but in any case, banks are connected to other banks because they have claims and liabilities from each other. Often a bank has both claims and liabilities to the same counterparty. Some of banks are more connected and some are a little bit less connected. In theory, we could have banks that function as some kind of hubs that could be small banks, but are very interconnected. So this interconnectedness subscore is designed to designate these banks as systemically important. But in reality, we don't have those banks. Usually, the bigger the bank is, the more connected it is. The score for interconnectedness consists of three items. Unsurprisingly, both interbank assets and interbank liabilities are included. Also, all debt securities that the bank has outstanding, they are included in this interconnectedness subscore. Then there is a score for substitutability that is much less straightforward than this interconnectedness score. one can see that accounting people have been designing this. I mean, have participated in designing this core. In economics, we are not very well aware of things like assets under custody. But in any case, the substitutability measures, short-term replaceability of a bank. If a bank goes poof, how fast you can replace all the services it offers. These banks are expected to disrupt the system in case they fail. So the substitutability consists of four items: assets under custody, then payments activity is included. It was one of the primary banking functions. Then underwritten transactions and also trading volume, although their weight is a little bit smaller than the weight for payments activity, for example. Then there is a score for complexity. The logic is this is a direct copy paste or the direct quotation from the GSIP document. The more complex a bank is, the greater the costs and time to resolve the bank. That is, if a bank fails, you need to clear the mess it causes. You need to resolve the bank. And this complexity score measures the costs of resolution. There are over-the-counter derivatives. This OTC or over-the-counter means that these derivatives are not standardized. Most of derivatives that banks use have a standardized form, but they also use these over-the-counter or OTC derivatives that are not standardized. So this complexity score includes them. Level 3 assets. One could ask that what is level 3 assets? It's a level 1 assets. It is cash. Level 3 assets are assets that don't have a value. If a bank fails, value for these assets has to be So level 3 assets are assets that have no value. And if a bank fails, we have to come up with a value for these assets. It's not as simple as it sounds. And trading and available for sale securities are a third part of this complexity score. Then there is a score for cross-border activity. The importance of activities outside the bank's home jurisdictions. This is once more a little bit more straightforward. It includes cross-jurisdictional claims and cross-jurisdictional liabilities. Even if a bank has a branch outside its home borders, they are included in these cross-jurisdictional claims and liabilities. Thus, there are 5 subscores, and these subscores are summed up. And as a result, we have a GSIP score: size, interconnectedness, substitutability, complexity, and cross-border activity. And the resulting score has a value between 0 and 10,000. 10,000 would mean that there is only one bank in the system or in the world. And the scores, these are quite low, even for the largest banks. So if a bank is a GSIP score, if its GSIP score is higher than the cutoff point, which is 130, so the maximum score is 10,000, so 130, it's only 1.3% of that. So if a bank has a score that is higher than 1.3%, it is designated as a GSIB. This cutoff point, it's given by the regulator. It's based on a cluster analysis. But basically, it is the subjective part of this process. Like I said earlier, this cluster analysis, when they speak about cluster analysis, it may sound very analytic, but in reality, it really is not. One can almost choose the results when he or she uses this cluster analysis to do something. And once we have designated, by the way, do you have something to ask? Am I going forward too fast? Hello?
I see no questions there in the chat room. So
okay, cool. Thank you.
I will raise those up with the, if they've got something.
Yeah, thank you. So once we have designated this GSIPs, every GSIP is given a capital buffer, and it has to be tier one EQD. That is the highest quality EQD, usually means own funds or profits. And the higher is the GSIP score, the larger is the capital buffer that banks has to have. And the bank has to hold this additional GSIP buffer on top of the required capital buffer. The capital requirement is 8% of total assets, I mean of risk-weighted total assets. So the GSIPs have to have this additional GSIP buffer on top of this regulatory minimum. So if a bank has, for example, a GSIP buffer of 2%, plus there is this regulatory minimum of 8%, a bank has to have 10% of capital at minimum. This is to lower the probability of default of these GSIP banks. I earlier showed this expected impact framework. We use this GSIP buffer to lower the expected impact of these systemically important banks to the level where the expected impact is of a bank that has this, has the GSIP score of 130 basis points. That is the cutoff bank that necessarily does not even exist. So currently there are five buckets in this GSIP framework. We divide or we split banks into buckets according to the GSIP score. For example, if a bank has the GSIP score in the range of 130 and 230, it is in the first bucket, and its GSIP buffer size is 1% of this tier one EQD. But for example, if its GSIP score is very high, around 500, it's in the fourth bucket, or in the fourth GSIP bucket, then its GSIP buffer is 2.5% of tier one EQD. These are public information. These are published in this GSIP framework, cutoff score and bucket thresholds. By the way, I will add all this supplementary material that I have into Moodle. I will create a folder. I have quite a lot of all kind of documents that I have downloaded from the web. You don't have to read them, you don't have to memorize them or anything, but it's good that you are aware of these documents. So this is I forgot to mention that this bucketing approach is only one approach that is used. It's used in the GSIP methodology, yes, but if there is also an alternative approach, it is this expected impact approach that uses a mathematical derivation. It's quite simple. You need first regression analysis for it. You need to estimate the alpha and the beta, but after you have those, you can actually calculate the amount of capital that is needed to level the expected impact of the GSIP to equal the expected impact of this benchmark bank. That is the bank that has the cutoff score of GSIP score of 130 basis points. This is not used by the regulator. This bucketing approach is more simple. and I believe it functions better than does this expected impact approach. But this expected impact is used by some jurisdictions when calculating the outsize scores. I will return to the outsize scores a bit later. But the objective is the same in both this bucketing approach and expected impact approach. This expected impact approach, it comes from the Federal Reserve Board 2015, calibrating the G-SIB surcharge. So these are the G-SIBs. In total, there are 30 G-SIBs in the world. I didn't list every one of them here, just a few examples. On top of all the buckets, there is an empty G-SIB bucket. This is to give the biggest bank incentives not to become more systemically important. As you can see, in the highest bucket or bucket four that includes banks is JP Morgan Chase. That is designated as the most systemically important bank in the world, according to this G-SIB methodology. Then in the bucket number three, there are Citigroup and HSBC. HSBC is a British bank. And then in the second bucket, well, there is Bank of America and Bank of China. By the way, these Chinese banks are something that we had never heard of only 10 to or 15 years ago. But today they are among the largest banks in the whole world. There are, I think, four banking giants in China. All of them are public sector banks. There is Bank of China, China Construction Banks, and two others. I can't recall their names right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if their systemic importance increases slightly every year. But as you can see in the second bucket, there are quite familiar names like Barclays, it's a British bank, then BNP, it's from France, and Deutsche Bank, it's from Germany. And in the lowest buckets, in the first bucket, there is Santander. It's a little bit surprising that it's so low in this bucketing approach, even if it's almost a global bank. But in any case, you remember the slide where I showed that the Santander made a loss of 8 billion euros in the Q2 of 2020. This is what these G-SIB buffers are designed for. When a systemically important bank makes losses, it always can use this or it always can release this G-SIB buffer that it has. In the case of Santander, it's 1% of Tier 1 equity. UniCredit is an Italian bank. Also, Nordea used to be in the first bucket of this G-SIB bucketing approach, but it was excluded. I mean, it was removed from the list. I think it was in 2019. It still was on the list in 2018, if I remember right. Also, these G-SIBs, they are public information. This is from 2019 list of global systemically important banks. But what is not public information is the specific scores. They don't release them or they don't release the subscores, which is a pity because those would contain useful information. But now we come to the question. We have a list of G-SIBs. Most of adults have heard of each of these banks. So why do we exactly need a score for systemic importance if almost anyone could name most of these G-SIBs? So why don't we use just expert judgment to designate these global systemically important banks? Well, Well, probably the reason is that it's politically more easier to have a kind of a fair and objective indicator-based score. And also in practice, these sub-scores, they very much all correlate with the size scores. I have personal, when I worked at the ECB, this was exactly what I did there. I calculated these scores of systemic importance, and one of the first results that I ever had was that these subscores, they have a correlation of 95% or something similar with the size score or with any other score. So why don't we use size to measure systemic importance? That has been used before by regulators, but what's the subscores actually can do that they can change the internal ranking of these banks slightly using the size scores to estimate the G-SIB scores. It probably would lead to a very similar list of 30 banks, but the ranking between these banks could be slightly different. So maybe the result is again, at least a little bit political, but what I'm trying to say that we could use bank size to measure systemic importance, we could manage quite well. But in any case, the score has subscores for complexity, interconnectedness, and so on. But in practice, it's bank size that matters. And from the academic point of view, this is a little bit complicated because lack of data, it really does prevent from replicating these G-SIB scores. We don't have data for cross-jurisdictional activity, or we don't have data for payments activity. This can be proxied by using bank size, and this is what academics do, because they don't have access to regulatory data. By the way, this regulatory data is it's extremely protected by central banks, because if it ends to wrong hands, those people might benefit from having access to it, because it contains sensitive and classified information. For example, at the ECB, I had access to regulatory data because I was doing research there, but you don't automatically have access to it. And also, I heard from a very reliable source that there are spies at the ECB that are trying to bribe people to give them access to this score. Also, where they have all the servers, hard drives, and so on. No one can access those areas at the ECB. You have to go through a retina scan or eye scanner to access those areas. So it's very protected, and academics don't have, they certainly don't have access to it because it would leak. But even central banks, they might experience problems in estimating this payments activity score. So it is in the OSI document, they actually do mention that if the regulator does not have access to payments activity, they can use reliable overestimates to estimate it. What does that precisely mean? What is a reliable overestimate? I don't know. But even the designer of this course admits that it might be problematic to get data to payments activity. So, concluding all this G-SIB framework is a step forward. We have systemically important banks, and if they fail, they devastate the whole system. We cannot take the risk. We cannot allow them to fail. So, this whole G-SIB framework is designed to decrease the likelihood of these major banks devastating the financial system. It also reduces the the negative externalities that relate to banks that know that they are important, which is this too big to fail, moral hazard or amplified risk-taking, market discipline, distorted competition, and so on. So to conclude, this GSIP framework really is a good change in the regulation, which makes you wonder that why didn't have we anything like this before? Well, probably no one, just we simply weren't aware of the problem of systemically important banks and what risks they pose to the system. Many lessons were learned during the financial crisis and sovereign debt crisis, and these lessons were used to design the new regulation. The score is global because a national score would not account for cross-border consequences, which takes us to our next subject. It's the OSI framework. We have 30 GSIB banks or global systemically important banks. It would be simply wrong to say that those are banks. I mean, all the banks that are systemically important banks. Of course, we have banks that are nationally systemically important. For example, in Finland, we have this cooperative banking group, Osuuspankki. It's very big in Finland, but it's not included on the list of GSIBs because it's not globally systemically important. So we have also a national framework, this OSI framework, which means other systemically important institution, abbreviated as OSI. This OSI methodology was designed after the GSIB methodology. That is, the GSIB was first and the OSI came second. The methodology, I mean the OSI methodology, it is, well, simply put, it is the GSIB framework applied to the national context. The document was published by the European Banking Authority in 2014. Guidelines on criteria for the assessment of OSIs. The earliest publication that I have found is from 2012. So it was, 1 year after the publication on the GSIB framework. So basically the idea in the framework, it's the same as in the GSIB framework, except that the objective is to identify domestic banks that are systemically important. For example, this Osuuspankki group in Finland. This is a list of OSIs and GSIBs in Finland. We used to have one GSIB, it's this Nordea. Well, it's not a GSIB anymore. It was removed from 2018, but it certainly is an OSI in Finland. Then we have this OP group or Osuuspankki group, that is the cooperative banking group. Then Kuntarahoitus or municipality finance, it's also included on the list of OSIs. I think in the euro area, the total number of OSIs, it's around 300 banks. So because the GSIB score was used as the starting point when designing this OSI score, it's quite close to the framework quite closely resembles the GSIB score. The subscores, they have been slightly adjusted for a reason that is not disclosed, which is a very, straightly put, it's a quite annoying habit. They don't give any motivation for the variables, why they actually are included in the OSI framework and why there have been changes compared to the GSIB framework. In my opinion, this GSIB framework is a little bit more democratic because it's they are quite open for the reasoning and for the motivation behind including the variables into the framework. But this OSI is different in this matter. They really don't disclose the reasoning behind the selected variables. But in any case, the big difference between these two frameworks is in the denominator, that is the divider in the score. In the OSI framework, the indicator variables are measured relative to national aggregates instead of global aggregates. For example, we compare German banks relative to German aggregates. We take Finnish banks, compare them relative to Finnish aggregates, and so on. The idea is exactly the same as in the GSIP framework, except that the denominator is national, not global. So what we have as a result is a score that measures a bank's systemic importance for the national banking system. This is quite straightforward, but this is also where the problems begin. This score does not function very well. Even the designer admits it. So similarly to the GSIP score, the range of scores, it's from 0 to 10,000. The OSI scores, they are much, much larger than the GSIP scores. For example, we have very centralized banking system. For example, in Baltic countries or in Finland, in practice, we have only a few banks that cover most of the banking assets that we have in our country. This Nordea and OP Group alone in Finland, probably they count for 65% of the banking assets. Well, maybe not that much, but half wouldn't be a bad guess. So, and also, especially in some subscores, for example, in over-the-counter derivatives or something else, there may only be one player in a banking system in Lithuania, for example. There are not many banks that participate in cross-border business or something similar. So especially these sub-scores, they might be very high for certain banks as compared to the GSIP scores that are quite low even for the largest banks. But instead of 5 subscores, the OSI score includes 4 subscores. There have been some changes. What are the reasons behind the changes? They don't tell them. But in any case, it's not very far from the GSIP framework. If you remember, the GSIP framework had 5 subscores. This is only 4. And what is different is this importance score. Well, it's a combination of loans and deposits and payments activity. That is the biggest difference to the GSIP framework. But excluding that, the subscores, they are similar to those of the GSIP methodology. For example, the subscores for size and interconnectedness are almost identical in both of these methodologies. And the difference is in the denominator. It's national instead of global. By the way, even if this denominator is national, the scope of the variable for the numerator, it's global. That is, if a bank domiciles in Finland, for example, Nordea, we take all the banking assets that are included, possessed by the banks in Finland, and compare Nordea's assets to those assets. So even if Nordea has assets outside Finland, for example, in Latin America or elsewhere, they are included in this OSI score. This is what causes problems what comes to identification of systemic importance. For example, when Nordea moved from Sweden to Finland, Nordea alone, it's bigger than most of the banks in Finland. So when Nordea moves from Sweden to Finland, does it make other Finnish banks less systemically important for the Finnish banking system? Of course it does not, but it still lowers their OSI scores because Nordea is an extremely large bank for the Finnish banking system. This is what distorts the scores. If there is a major bank in the banking system, it makes all the other banks look much smaller than they really are. So the ratio or this OSI score, it measures a bank's global assets relative to all the bank assets in the banks that domicile in the same country. Here it is illustrated. I use Finland as an example. So if a bank just domiciles, if its headquarters are in Finland, every bank asset all around the world is included in Finland. And local banks that operate in Finland, their assets are compared to the assets that might locate somewhere else on different continents. For example, this Nordea, it makes banks that operate only in Finland look like midgets. By the way, well, I will return to this a little bit later, but you probably guess what is the problem with the OSI score. It is the designation of systemically important banks. The subscore for importance, it differs from the GC framework because the GC framework doesn't even include a score for importance. But this measures, well, as the name suggests, it measures how important a bank is for the banking system. Here is something that is, in my opinion, a bit illogical. As you can see, the scope in the variables for private sector deposits and private sector loans is the European Union. The scope is no longer global. For some reason, they changed the scope from global to the European Union. Why they do this? They don't say it. I have asked this from people, but no one could answer. Maybe the reason is, again, political. This is something that I don't know, and I can't know, but this really doesn't make much sense because it's surprisingly out from nowhere, the scope changes from global to the European Union. But in any case, the importance score, it measures the importance for the real economy. This is where also the payment transactions or the payment activity is included. And it's very straightly mentioned in the OSI publication that necessarily even central banks don't have data for payment transactions. And the subscore for complexity, it's a combination of GSIP scores for complexity and cross-border activity. We have cross-jurisdictional liabilities and claims and these over-the-counter derivatives. I mentioned that this indicator variable for OTC derivatives, it can be very high for some banks, Lithuanian banks or Finnish banks, because most banks don't have these over-the-counter derivatives. If they use derivatives, they always use standardized forms of these derivatives. Only big banks use these over-the-counter derivatives. The result that we have, that is the OSI score, it's a familiar looking score. It's not distant from the GSIP score, except that the subscores have been slightly changed. But in any case, we again have a score that is between 0 and 10,000. And even the designer of the OSize score admits that it does not necessarily capture a systemically important banks, because banking sectors are different. We have sectors that are very centralized, and we have sectors that are not. We have sectors that have dominant players, and we have banking sectors that have not. For example, the banking sector of Luxembourg is totally different than the banking sector of Estonia, for example. Therefore, this OSI methodology, it includes a second stage where banks are designated as OSIs using expert judgment. That is, in practice, they are just decided by the regulator that a bank is an OSI. This first stage, or this indicator-based stage, it is designed to identify those banks as OSIs that must be OSIs. This is explicitly and clearly stated in the document that concerns this methodology. So what is a major difference between the GSIP methodology and the OSI methodology is that this OSI methodology is much more subjective than the GSIP methodology. There also are banking system where national systemic importance is measured using a national scope for the variables. For example, in the United Kingdom, they have been doing that. Whether they do it anymore, I'm not sure about that. But at least in the past, they used to have an OSI methodology where they measure British banks' assets relative to banking assets only in the UK. This is the other way to do this, but this is very much disencouraged by the designer of the OSI score. The reason it's very simple, because ultimately the local taxpayers may have to carry the burden of the failed global activities. If a bank that domiciles in the UK fails in Latin America, it is the British taxpayers that might carry the cost of this. This is why it's encouraged to include every asset in the OSI score, even if it may distort the scores of the banks that operate only locally. The project that I had at the ECB when I worked there was to design a score for European systemic importance. It was the ESI score. Well, the result that I had in the end after working for 11 months was that there really is no need for such a score, because we can simply take the GSIP scores of all the European banks and interpret those as the ESI scores using just a different threshold. But in any case, we examined whether we should measure this systemic importance relative to global banking assets or to banking assets only in the euro area. Well, our conclusion was that it would give a totally wrong signal if the ECB said that we don't care about the banking assets outside the euro area. It's quite obvious that the ECB never could give such a signal to markets or to anywhere else. But in the UK, they do this. So according to their regulators, it is only the UK that matters, and nothing else on this planet does not. It's not a very nice idea, even though probably it's not their intention. What they are trying to do is identify the banks that are systemically important for the banking system in the UK. Well, I had something in my mind, but it is escaped. It seems that I'm half an hour too early. I was quick. This is all I have to say for this time about systemic importance. Do you have any questions related to the GCP framework or the OSI framework or anything else?
Okay, any questions? If you want to ask something out loud, then just press the space bar in your keyboard and you can ask. I just have one question to you, Jari-Mikko. When you are talking about capital requirements, I suppose that you always, in this regulation, you always refer to the bank capital, which means that you are calculating the difference between the assets and liabilities.
Yes.
Basically you always have this 8% reference point at the moment, so everything that has been that Jari-Mikko has been presenting here is above that 8% requirement basically. Okay, so anyone else, do you have any other questions? No. Okay, thanks Jari-Mikko. And we will continue. You can obviously send questions to Jari-Mikko directly, also through email, if you have something in mind after the when you listen this recording, for example, outside this actual meeting. So you can obviously ask Jari-Mikko if you have some specific questions, because he has been working with these things there in the ECB, so he has very up-to-date information about these things. Okay, but if no one has any questions, then we will meet again tomorrow at 9 o'clock or 9:50.